How many of you have ever felt like you just don't have enough? You felt like that? You don't have enough time. You don't have enough energy. You don't have enough skill or talent. You don't have enough money. Anybody feel that? You don't have enough money. You don't have enough patience. Anybody there? You don't have enough patience. You don't have enough love. And you just don't have enough to do the life that you've been given right now. Well, if you feel like that, you're not alone. As a matter of fact, this last week, I've already told you, was probably one of the hardest weeks of my ministry, and I honestly wondered how I was going to get through the week. I had no idea how I was going to get to this point right here where I'm standing with you, and I actually have a sermon to deliver. Because I didn't get to this until yesterday. And normally my sermon is done on Monday, and then I tweak it throughout the week, but it's by and large done Monday. I didn't get to it. It was a super hard week. I had to meet with Daryl and June several times and walk through things with them, and plus I had a wedding yesterday, and I had to prepare a message for that. And there so many good things happened last week, but it was difficult as well with what we already talked about. And I kept on asking God, give me strength to get through this week. And it was like he kept on telling me, just do the next right thing and then trust me. Do the next right thing and trust me. And I think there are times when we all feel like that, when we feel like we don't have enough. I do not have what it takes to do the life that I've been given right now. And there are times when probably sometimes we feel like we don't, that the times we do feel like we have enough are so few and far between. And we don't know how to get through. Can anyone relate to that? You feel unequal to the task that you've been given? We're nearing the end of our Encounters with Jesus series. We've taken a look at several encounters over the last few months, and we have a couple more after this one. But today, as we talked about in the announcements, we're going to go to the park, to the school field, and we're going to have a picnic. And we're going to celebrate. We're going to take a look back and at the encounters that we've had with Jesus over the last several weeks. And how has Jesus touched our lives and changed our hearts through those encounters as we've dug in with his word and as we've interacted with him and with other people over the last several weeks. And I've heard several of you tell me that your thinking has been changed, your mindset has been changed through these Encounters with Jesus series. And so we're going to have a chance to encounter, to encourage each other today. And that's what an encounter with Jesus should do. He takes what we give him, the meager offering that we give him, the meager gifts that we give him, and he takes them as we humbly and authentically offer them to him, and then he multiplies them, and then he uses it to bless and serve others. And then we get to experience joy. One of my favorite passages, things that Jesus said, is Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Jesus said, come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Sometimes I marinate in that, especially this last week. Take my yoke upon you. Let me teach you, because I am humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy to bear, and the burden I give you is light. We need to know this. We need to believe this, not just know it intellectually. We need to believe this from our hearts. We need to, if we are going to become more and more like our Master, Jesus, we have to believe that he wants to teach us. We have to believe that he is humble and gentle. If we're going to come to him, we need to believe that it's true, that his yoke is easy to bear and the burden he gives us is light. And we need to also know that our encounters with Jesus will produce good fruit if we allow him to change us. Now, how often do we go through life as if it's a drudgery and we're on our own? And we can take a look at June's situation right now, June and Daryl's situation, and think, well, they're all on their own and we put them there. Well, that's not true. It's so easy to forget that Jesus is in the middle of the storm with us. And when we forget that Jesus wants to actually use the storm to transform our hearts and our minds so that we're more like him, if we forget that, what happens is we play the victim. And then we don't learn from the experience that we just had. We forget that Jesus wants to use the storm to transform our lives, to help us to grow. And he's big enough for that storm. Well, today we're going to look at another encounter and another grow opportunity that Jesus gave his apprentices. And this is a big one. It's one of Jesus' most well-known miracles. And he gathered a huge following from this miracle because of it. Before we take a look at what it is, I want to share a little bit of background information leading up to it. Now, the big event that happened just before this encounter that we're looking at this morning is that Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, was beheaded. Now, that'd be pretty bad news to take, wouldn't it? So Jesus' cousin is beheaded. Herod Antipas, who was the puppet king, the Jewish puppet king, made a stupid promise to a pretty dancing girl at a party that he had thrown, that he was so pleased with this girl's dancing that he said, "I'll give you whatever you want, up to half the kingdom." And it's a promise that he made, and he made it in front of his guests, and this dancing girl didn't know what to ask for, so she goes to her mother and says, "Mother, what should I ask for?" And she said, "Ask for the head of John the Baptist on a platter." Now, that's pretty weird, don't you think? Because Herod was offering her up to half the kingdom. You can have up to half my kingdom, and there was so much hatred in her heart for John the Baptist. And instead of asking for half the kingdom or a whole bunch of money or something, she asked for the head of John the Baptist. Just very, very strange. And Herod complied. Even though he liked John the Baptist, he liked listening to him, even though John the Baptist said some very uncomfortable things. But Herod didn't want to be embarrassed in front of the other guests by going back on his promise. Now, that's a bit strange, too. Because he was more comfortable with lopping off the head of John the Baptist and John the Baptist losing his head than he was losing his own face. That's pretty strange. And that's what fear does to us, right? Fear and jealousy and all those kinds of things blurs our thinking. So we do the stupid things. About that same time, Jesus sent out his 12 apprentices, his 12 disciples, two by two, to preach the good news of the kingdom, to preach that there's freedom instead of slavery to the law. There, you can have true freedom if you follow Jesus in his kingdom. And he sent them out, his disciples, two by two, preaching this and casting out demons and healing people of their diseases. And I believe it was during this ministry trip, when Jesus was at home, all the other disciples were out doing ministry, that Jesus got the news about his cousin John the Baptist. Well, Jesus' fame continued to spread. He got more and more famous. The crowds around him grew, and they all wanted a piece of him. And this event is one of the few that's in all four Gospels, so it's super important. And some of them tell us that as soon as Jesus heard this news that his cousin had been killed, he wanted to get alone with his disciples so he could just get some quiet, get to a quiet place where he could debrief, where he could receive from his Father, where he could recover and grieve. And so we're pick it up there. And Jesus is going to feed several thousand people with just a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish. So Mark chapter 6, I know your bulletin says that it's in Luke, but it's actually in Mark chapter 6. It's in all four Gospels, and I've chosen to use we're having trouble here, aren't we, with the audio. Are we okay? So Mark chapter 6, starting in verse 32. So they left by boat for a quiet place where they could be alone. So Jesus' cousin, just remember Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist, has just been killed. Jesus wants some quiet so he can grieve. And in his humanness, he is exhausted. He's been spending all his time, all his energy, everything that he has ministering to people who are in need. And he wants some alone time right now just to get away with his disciples so he can debrief and think things through. Verse 33, but many people recognized them and saw them leaving, and people from many towns ran ahead along the shore and got there ahead of them. So Jesus and his disciples get into a boat and they head across the lake, the Sea of Galilee. Now picture this in your mind. All four Gospels say that there are people coming from all over the place, from towns all over the place, to follow Jesus. And Mark says that they saw where he was going and they followed along the shore. And so they're watching the boat. Picture the crowd in your mind running along the seashore, along the Sea of Galilee, keeping their eye on the boat, watching where he's going, running along the shore so that they can get ahead of Jesus. The only quiet that Jesus would have is in the boat with the disciples before they get to the other side. Verse 34, Jesus saw the huge crowd as he stepped from the boat, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and so he began teaching them many things. Now, John's gospel says that once Jesus landed, he climbed a hill with his disciples and he sat down to teach them. And so I think probably it happened like this, that they landed the boat. Jesus and his disciples climb a hill. He sits down to start teaching the disciples, and then he sees the crowds. And he has compassion. He looks at them, and he has compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. He's exhausted. He spent everything he had. Everything, almost. And he sees the crowd of people, and he looks at them, and he has compassion on them because they were like a sheep without a shepherd. And then he began to teach them. And some of the other Gospels say that he not only taught them, but he also healed them of their diseases. Verse 35, late in the afternoon, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the nearby farms and villages to buy something to eat." Now the disciples look around and they assess the situation. There are thousands of people. There are 5,000 men. There are 5,000 men plus their families. And so do the math. If not all the men would be married, but probably most of them were. And if most of them had a wife and a couple of kids, do the math. There are thousands of people. Some of them are going to have more than a couple kids. So thousands of people. The disciples are very obviously and naturally concerned because they aren't going to be able to take care of these people. And so for some reason, they think that Jesus must not have thought this through very carefully. Jesus doesn't really, he's not prepared for this. So we're going to have to give him a directive. We'll tell him what to do. Don't let the problem of the crowds become our problem. That's what they're saying, basically. But Jesus said, "You feed them." With what? That's how I imagine their intonation. With what? Feed them with what? What do we have? We've got nothing. There are thousands of people here. We'd have to work for months to earn enough money to buy food for all these people. How many of you do that with God? You know, you want to follow Jesus, and he says, okay, here's something for you to do. With what? I don't have what it takes. I don't have the gifts. I don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the money. I don't have the patience to work with that person. I don't have enough love. My heart's not big enough. With what? I don't have, I don't have, I don't have. Jesus says, verse 38, how much bread do you have? So what do you have? With what? Well, what do you have? Go and find out. And they came back and they reported, we have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. And so the disciples, again, imagine this in your mind. There are thousands of people. They're sitting on the ground. And they go throughout the crowd saying, who has food? Anybody have food here? Does anybody have food? And they come back and they report to Jesus what they found. And they say, we've got 5 small barley loaves of bread and 2 small fish. That's it. John's gospel tells us that it was actually a young boy who had the food. Just a young boy with a meager supply of food. It wasn't much, but he gave it all. Now, he didn't have to give it. He could have said, no, this is my food. If I give it to you, then I'm going to go hungry. And so I need to hoard this food for myself. It's mine, 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 mine. And you can't have any because it's mine. My mummy made it for me before I came here. And it's mine. And she said, don't share it with anybody because it's mine. Or he could have just hidden it and he could have felt silly at the meager amount that he had and said, well, this obviously isn't going to do the trick, so why even mention it? You know, I'm just going to look silly by saying I have this to give. But he didn't do that. He offered what he had. Now, the disciples, the apprentices of Jesus in John chapter 6, verse 9, it says there's a young boy here. They're reporting back. It said there's a young boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what good is that with this large crowd, this huge crowd? And so they were doing the thing that probably most of us would do. It's what good is that? Verse 39, Mark 6. Then Jesus told the disciples to have the people sit down in groups on the green grass. And so he doesn't listen to their directive. I don't know about you, but whenever I give Jesus a directive, it doesn't really go the way I planned. Because he knows better than I do. So he got them to sit down on the grass, and they sat down in groups of 50 or 100. And Jesus took the 5 loaves and 2 fish. He looked up toward heaven and blessed them. Then breaking the loaves into pieces, he kept giving the bread. He kept giving the bread. You've got to imagine that in your mind too. The disciples are coming to him. They got 5 loaves. They got 2 fish. He kept giving them the bread and the fish. He kept giving it to them. There are thousands of people, and he kept giving it to them. So they could distribute it to the people. He also divided the fish for everyone to share. And they all ate as much as they wanted. And afterward, the disciples picked up 12 baskets of leftover bread and fish. A total of 5,000 men and their families were fed. We think we don't have enough. Right? What do I have? And we don't have enough. They didn't have enough. But what we do have, we can offer it to Jesus and he can multiply it. I see that happening at CRBC all the time. People come to other staff and they say, you know, I don't have much to give. I don't have a lot of skill. I don't have a lot of talent. But what can I do? And then there is a ripple effect from what we do in God's kingdom. You know, I think of the we need people serving in audiovisual. We need people serving in children's ministry. We need people serving in outreach. We need people serving in all the various ministries at this church. And when you do, you multiply. It multiplies. Multiple people are blessed because you are serving. The audiovisual people right now, there are people being trained right now. And when they're all behind the scenes, you don't see what goes on behind there. And Sunday mornings, it's like the duck under the water going like this. And on top, he's all calm. You see the calm. And underneath, the duck is going crazy. That's what happens Sunday mornings. And that's because they're doing their job. And so we praise God for them. And in every single ministry, we give what we have humbly and authentically, and then Jesus multiplies it. It's beautiful. I see it happening over and over and over again. I got an email this last week in which I saw this principle so clearly, and I asked Natalie, who sent me the email, if I could share it with Ruthie and the other staff, and she gave me the go-ahead, and I read it to the staff at our farewell party for Bob this last week, and I had a hard time getting through it without weeping uncontrollably. As a matter of fact, I didn't get through it. I was so moved by how Jesus is using the people of CRBC to touch the life of this woman, and how her simple faith is being multiplied, and how she, as she humbly gives what she has to Jesus. It was so powerful. And so I asked her if I could read that email to you this morning, and here's how she answered. She said, "I am comfortable with you reading it, just so long as I don't have to stand up or wave. LOL. Yes, I'm that type of shy. I'm elated it has affected more than just me. I'm still in awe of the love and support of God's love when he works through people who are dedicated to his messages. Though he takes as well as he gives, there's always a bigger picture that we don't yet see. If someone told me 20 years ago how the next few decades would unfold, I wouldn't have gotten my 12-year-old self out of bed. But he's always at work and knows best. The faith I have is ever present. I don't expect instant gratification or change in myself and my journey. It will take time and work. But little by little, such changes add up to create the new. And the church is a constant presence that continues to support and encourage my path, whatever that may be, and wherever it will take me." And so I'm going to read her email to you right now, and it's very long, and so I'm going to sit down. But it's very engaging, so get comfortable and just see how God has worked in the heart of Natalie and how he's multiplying. That's the key here. He is multiplying what we give him. So listen to her story. "Hello, Jeff. My name is Natalie. I regularly attend service at CRBC on Sundays, and my 6-year-old son attends Powerhouse and Christ Kids. This past Sunday, the service was emotionally overwhelming in a good way. Though Steve was running the service, I felt the need to email you. At the risk of sounding like a stalker, I'm really harmless. You just happened to be in the store at the same time as me. I was at the thrift store today, and it may have been you in front of me paying for your fines. He sounded like you and looked like you. So much went through my head at that moment because this past Sunday is still clear in my heart about patches and mixing old wine with new. I wanted to share with you how much the church has enriched my faith and renewed my trust in God. The thing is, I'm very reserved and awkward. Like, how can I say, 'Hey, Jeff, wow, I'm Natalie, so nice to meet you. Has CRBC turned my spiritual life around or what?' Go on, breathless, excited, spewl, only to discover, 'Oops, wrong gentleman, enjoy your day and your awesome purchases,' and pray to forget what just unfolded." Now, that wasn't me there, so it wasn't me. So if she would have done that, she would have been a little bit embarrassed. She continues, "I grew up in northern B.C., where the church was strict and scary, the moment I had a say in whether or not I would go, I stopped. Though I never strayed in my love and belief in God and Jesus, I had little to no desire to attend another church, painting all with the same brush from early experiences. Unfair, I know. There was so much judgment, intolerance for others, and impossible rules, I felt maybe there was a miscommunication somewhere between the pastor and the Bible. Any church that wasn't us is bad. Disagreeing with us is bad. Questioning us is bad. Mainstream music was evil. Coffee was evil. Smoking was evil. Though I agree with the last one, cigarettes, not the smoker though. My parents were hooked to the church and their teachings. I moved to Camel River 3 years ago and wasn't looking for another church, but very open to a sign that I would find one. Well, true story. I'm driving, and what does my four-year-old son see but a bright flashing sign? Literally, sitting there and blinking on dogwood. He asked what it said. Powerhouse. Youth group. Ever the social butterfly, he asked to attend. Naturally, I had my reservations. My husband said he'll be fine, and it's good to have him around more kids his age. He's familiar with Jesus. We pray, and I read him Bible stories, but I knew that that wouldn't be enough to sustain his involvement with God. I put it off and put it off and put it off, and what did my son do? He learned to read. Specifically, everyone welcome. So I agreed to let him go, but made it clear the moment I feel a bad vibe or hesitate, that's it. Maybe he'll find another bright sign or pretty picture at another church. Well, I met a wonderful lady named Leora, who was very welcoming and warm. My son had fun, and it became a regular attendance. It didn't stop there. Now my son wanted to go on Sundays. God is very patient indeed, because it was about 20 years since I last went to a church, and 2 years since my son noticed the CRBC sign. So last November, I agreed to attend and opened up to the idea of designating myself to a church. I haven't been feeling the same since. My heart was restless, scared, and angry before I went to CRBC, and I hope it's okay to say why that is. In 2005, I lost both my parents on Christmas Day. They were both sick, and we had time to prepare. Even though they belonged to a strict church, they loved and gave everything they had to those who needed it without question. I grew up with six siblings, and any combination of relationships with each other was always strained, and it hasn't been the same since my parents died. It wasn't greed, because my parents didn't have anything to leave behind. It wasn't favoritism, because they loved us all equally. But I think because maybe we all turned from their church, we felt no tolerance for each other. We were easy to anger and slow to forgive. This conflict created a rift we felt we brought upon ourselves with hurtful words as well as unsaid words that could have repaired damage. None of us are close to our aunts and uncles or cousins. We never had grandparents. We were all alone. Then in 2014, after years of severe spousal abuse and raising a low-functioning autistic son by herself with little or no help from family, we had all moved away by that point, and few resources for families with autistic children, my sister Angie committed suicide after taking the life of her 16-year-old son Robert. She was 39. There is absolutely nothing quiet about this incident. It made national news. Our estranged families wanted even less to do with us. Comments and anger from strangers became a daily event. I prayed a lot. I wasn't asking for a miracle. I was asking for strength to be a mother, to get out of bed, and to let the media storm wash over me like water off a duck. I figured I had 30 years of surviving hard times, so the odds were in my favor that I'd survive this too. That was my first broken heart. When my parents died, my heart was heavy each day we knew drew closer to their time. We knew it was coming and said what we needed to. When I got the call about Angie, it took everything I had not to fall apart. We didn't believe it to be a possibility. A huge part of me wanted to believe her ex-husband did it so that I could have someone else to blame and he'd face some sort of mortal justice while we were alive. It felt like a tiny me was standing on top of this ripping heart, and the stitch holding it all together was coming undone like a shoelace, and I was trying very hard to pull it together so it wouldn't completely separate. She was the only sister that talked to every one of our siblings. She felt we needed to tolerate and accept each other because our time in this life is short. We didn't listen. She was our physical God's love. She was forgiving, patient, selfless, and funny. It hurts me to describe her like that because of how her life ended. She was painted into a corner with her son. She was told he would be placed in a home with addicts and mentally disturbed people for the lack of homes for autistic people. She couldn't let that happen. If he were abused or neglected, he'd have no way of telling her. She was told by the ministry the only places available were far, far away from home, and even then the wait list was years long. Robert's tantrums left holes in the wall, broken furniture, Angie's broken bones, and broken heart. Robert was 220 pounds, nonverbal, violent, and unpredictable. Angie was 100 pounds, and when she wasn't calling the cops on her violent and unpredictable addict of an ex-husband, she was alone. The RCMP asked me to describe her life. The only thing that came to mind was that should I ever do something in this life that lands me somewhere so dark, lonely, and vengeful as hell, it would be Angie's life. No amount of money from us could have protected her or cured Robert. But for years we tried to fix her problems. Because for years she helped us without a thought or expectation that she should receive anything back in return. After we said goodbye, I tried to repair the damage between me and my remaining siblings. I tried talking to them, emailing them, writing them letters, and remembering their birthdays and calling it Christmas. If I thought things were bad before, they only got worse. I have nieces and nephews and in-laws I haven't met. I couldn't pinpoint which towns they live in all over BC. I was so angry that they weren't doing what I felt they needed to be doing. Patches, expectations, mixing of wine. I let it eat away at my relationships with other people. I tolerated less. I wasn't patient or kind. I was always looking for the negative. I allowed my relationships with my husband and kids to sour. I rejected friends before I feared they would reject me. I became unreliable at keeping plans. I was quick to judge and took a lot of joy in finding faults and pointing them out. This past Sunday, Steve was talking about the Pharisees and their rules and how following the rules alone doesn't mean you don't need Jesus. I can continue to follow the Ten Commandments and it won't do anything to help how I feel or how I can repair my family. We need Jesus. I've always known that, but this past Sunday I realized just how much anger and hate I have inside me because I'm trying to patch things up and make my world into this neat and tidy mold, but all along I'm just trying to fit a square into a circle and call them family. I learned from my time so far at CRBC that it's hard. Life is hard. It takes a lot of work to follow Jesus and walk with him. It takes a lot of work to practice the teachings of the Bible. A few Sundays ago, I remember, who are we to judge? Jesus walked with the thieves and tax collectors. He worked through shady characters to get his work done. He was God's son, and even he didn't judge, so who are we? I've dug myself into this comfortable spiritual hole where I can see faults and judge them. I can hide and turn my back when something doesn't go my way. It's going to take a lot of work to get out and create new habits that are positive and a reflection of God's love. I honestly don't know how my son turned out to be so social, accepting, and patient. I don't know how many times we drove past that sign, and I said, maybe next week. The Bible seems so simple every time I hear a sermon at CRBC. I'm like, how easy and wonderfully put. The lesson, it's got to be common knowledge. But knowledge and practice are two very different things. I can know a tomato is a fruit, but put that in with my fruit salad and it's not going to taste so great. What CRBC has that I found so much in my past experience lacked was acceptance. That we're not perfect. It takes work, and that's okay. Growing up, mistakes weren't okay. Asking questions and confessing weaknesses was not okay. At the end of the service this past Sunday, they played Come As You Are. And like anyone of my generation, I fell in love with the song and Googled the lyrics to find various versions and make myself a playlist on YouTube of just that one song. I feel relief, acceptance, tolerance, and love every time I hear that song. It's like an epiphany that everyone else got earlier than me. My son's birthday party is this Saturday, and I'm inviting some of my husband's estranged family. I dreaded it since my son's last birthday. I carry a lot. After church, I was so emotionally charged, I couldn't share with my husband what I had heard and felt. I waited until I felt I had digested it enough to form a sentence without shaking my head. The thing about my husband is he's open, but not open enough to attend church. He grew up Catholic and learned about the witch hunts, the residential schools, and oppression. So he shied away from it and hasn't been in a church since he was a kid. But I share with him the notes I take, the realizations I have, and the personal goals I have for myself. He's very supportive until he decides on his own or receives a sign. Apparently that was my sign, the dogwood sign. I don't know why we couldn't share. It's big and nice enough. I'll continue to pray and share with him. Wow, that turned out longer than I thought. But I wanted to share with you how much CRBC means to me and how I came to believe again. And follow my son and his eager young heart. Best, enjoy your week. Best regards, Natalie. I haven't met Natalie yet. Apparently she's somewhere here. And she said she'd introduce herself to me. Sure. She said she'd introduce herself to me after the service. Jesus used Natalie to impact me profoundly. And he's going to continue. He multiplies. Look at how her story has been multiplied already. Her story, humbly and authentically offered to Jesus, and he multiplied it. He did that this morning, and he's going to continue doing it. And friends, that is why we do what we do at CRBC. That's why we're here. That's why we give. That's why we serve. That's why we use our gifts and our talents. That's why we spend our energy so that there can be this ripple effect of people being touched by the gospel of Jesus that gives freedom. And that's why we will never stop being on mission for Jesus. And you may think this morning that you don't have much to give. You may feel like that little boy with, what do I have? It's just 5 loaves and 2 fish. I could keep it for myself because I need it. Or I could be ashamed to say, no, I don't have much to give. It's silly to me even offer what I have. Or you could just humbly and authentically say, this is what I have. Offer it to Jesus and let him multiply it. And then watch what happens. Let's pray. Father, thank you Thank you for Natalie and her son, her family, and we just pray blessing on them. We pray that you would fill them, that you would meet their needs, that you would multiply their love, Lord. And we pray for each of us here, Lord, that we would offer what we have to you, and that you would multiply it, and that we would see the fruit. And so we just humbly, authentically, courageously open our hands and say, will you use what I have? Thank you, Jesus.